Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. In this series, we will be talking with organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who are working both to challenge the Trump administration and the circumstances that created it. It can be easy to despair, to feel like trends toward inequality are impossible to stop, to give in to fear over increased racist, sexist, and xenophobic violence. But around the country, people are doing the hard work of fighting back, coming together to plan for what comes next. This series will introduce you to some of them.
Greetings. My name is Kali Okuno. I am the co-director of Cooperation Jackson. Cooperation Jackson is an emerging cooperative innovative project in Jackson, Mississippi. And the overall aim and intent is to create a vibrant social solidarity economy in Jackson and more thoroughly to use that to transform the local political economy of Jackson in the state of Mississippi, i.e. to take it over and to move it in a more radical direction.
And so you are part of a new project that is launching called Ungovernable 2017. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Ungovernable project, you know, it started election night. There was a video chat that myself and Cooperation Jackson hosted as part of an ongoing project that we have called an American Nightmare project, which is focused on the question of disposability, labor disposability, particularly the disposability of the black working class. And it's kind of a canary in the mine type subject. And we wanted to have a conversation that night to really try to sharpen in on what forces such as ours throughout the United States could and should be doing in the next period, kind of regardless of the outcome. Now, truthfully, myself and many others thought that Trump was going to win very early on from some analysis that we had been doing. So a lot of it was really just trying to prepare ourselves and prepare others to start having an open and honest dialogue about what the next, you know, 4 years, assuming that the democratic order will stay in place. I have many questions as to whether that's going to be the case. We can probably get to that later. But, you know, out of that just came, you know, one, it was clear that he had won the Electoral College and that he was going to be the next president of the United States. You know, just a casual kind of conversation point that I raised is like, now we need to prepare to be ungovernable. And, you know, that kind of lingered in my head. And it's a phrase that I remember picking up from my younger days that came from the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s as part of their non-compliance campaign and strategy, which was being employed from the 70s throughout the 80s and into the early 90s. So just kind of drawing on that historical memory is where that kind of phrase came from. But the general idea of the project is really to start propagating ideas on how to build and resist this next, you know, incoming regime, which from our vantage point, we want to really point out to everybody, you know, I think, you know, there's a focus on Trump, which is necessary, but I think we miss the boat if we don't really look at the Republican-controlled Congress, the Republican-controlled Supreme Court, which is now basically inevitability. And then if we don't look at the fact that Republicans control two-thirds of all of the state governments, right? So we're looking at a major right-wing shift I think the likes of this country have never seen before. And it's a minority movement. And it's a minority government in every instance. I think we really need to be mindful of that. And we're going to have to really, I think, dig deep and figure out how to develop a comprehensive program that enables us to survive this kind of neoliberal austerity onslaught that they're coming with and they're going to come hard with. And how do we use it not only to pivot to resistance, but to actually create the new future that we need and to see this, you know, as much as an opportunity to do many things that were kind of off the table 3 or 4 years ago, and just even in terms of ideas, you know, let's build a program to do that. And so the Ungovernable Project, you know, first and foremost, we're trying to galvanize and mobilize forces throughout the country and throughout the world to take action on January 20th. But beyond that, we really want to engage in creating a larger conversation on how to build a serious resistance program.
I want to back up because you said that you did think that Trump was going to win, which was certainly a thing that I think Trump himself didn't seem to think he was going to win. So can you talk a little bit about the analysis that you had that really led you to be not surprised and preparing for this already?
Well, I have the benefit of living in Mississippi, as odd as that may seem, and, you know, just saw the enthusiasm for Trump. I listened to a lot of right-wing and reactionary radio, in part by, you know, force of the political reality in the context in which I'm in, but also to study, you know, what these forces are doing, how they're doing it, who they're reaching, you know, what is their impact. And I just really started looking in September at the Electoral College map and having a, you know, clear understanding of the Electoral College process. And the map lined up pretty favorably for Trump. Now, I never thought that he would win the popular vote, but you don't need to win the popular vote in the United States to win the presidency. And, you know, it was very clear to me that if he could win a few key states, North Carolina, Ohio, Florida, you know, Michigan, that he had a shot. You know, there was clearly no enthusiasm in the black community for Hillary Clinton. I mean, she, a couple of different places, I just happened to be on the road when she was having events, you know, in different cities throughout the country and when she came here to Mississippi. And throughout, you know, even though she spent 8 years really building up the infrastructure to prepare her for this presidential run, she just couldn't overcome the historic deficit in the black community around people really just not believing in her and nor forgetting, you know, what her and her husband did during their 8 years in the White House, the 1990s, that resulted in, you know, the largest number of people in history being incarcerated kind of under their watch, part of which they were responsible for promoting and advocating. People didn't forget her super predator comments. So, you know, even though she did a lot to really support financially, you know, institutions like the Congressional Black Caucus and, you know, the Black Democratic Party machine, they couldn't, she couldn't turn that into votes. She couldn't turn that into mobilization. Obama got out there and was imploring, you know, everybody out to go and vote. And if people didn't, you know, vote, particularly black people who he was talking about, the black community, that if they didn't vote for Hillary, he would take it personal, and it was a personal affront. Despite all of that, they knew, I think, deep down inside, looking at all of their real metrics, I think they knew that they were in trouble. And I don't think people were paying enough attention to, you know, some clear and ominous signs. And I think one of them was, you know, one of the things that clearly let me know that she was vulnerable was, by all accounts, Bernie should not have stood a chance in hell at actually challenging her, given how much money she had her war chest, you know, how she had been basically, you know, buying allegiances for over, you know, almost a decade, had the money to back it, had the finance capital and virtually almost all of Wall Street on her side, and they were struggling. You know, he almost, I think if it would have been a legitimate contest, he probably would have won. But I think Trump was a very astute, is a very astute politician. I don't think none of his antics are random. I think he that he comes off that way to disarm people, but he's very calculating. He's very keen. Some moves that he did, particularly in the black community, one that I'll cite just for the audience. You know, I know there were some folks that I know of who were trying to get Hillary to address issues of concerns about the Clinton Foundation and its actions in Haiti and how they basically supported a very, you know, and it helped them install a very repressive and reactionary regime in Haiti. And some Haitian activists were trying to get her to speak to certain concerns, and they basically ignored the Haitian community, ignored the Haitian leadership. Trump very skillfully went to Florida on two occasions that I'm aware of and talk to a lot of the Haitian leadership, much of which is actually left wing. And, you know, he played up on, you know, the dislike, the outright hatred that, that many have for the Clinton Foundation and the Clintons and what they've been doing in Haiti. And, you know, to, for him to go and just try to get, you know, at best 10, 20,000 votes, you know, from the Haitian community means that he was doing some serious math. And he realized, hey, this could add up. And if I can just break what is typically considered the black, you know, vote, it will help me and my chances in Florida and some other key states to turn the tide. And it was just looking at those moves, looking at that electoral map, really looking at the economic anxiety in the black community, but also in the white community. You know, which is very real in Mississippi, very real in the South, very real in the Midwest. And I don't think that was being heard. That wasn't being really paid attention to. And I think he picked up on it. You know, he did everything he could on several occasions, as you remember, to very visibly and very publicly appeal to Bernie voters, you know, say, hey, I'm on your side. We're talking the same economic measures and concerns, which is not true. But I mean, it was great rhetoric. And I think their rhetoric went a long way. And then I think the, also the reality, you know, a deeper piece is that, you know, there was an economic populism, economic nationalism that he presented, I think in a very craftful way. And I think he did enough, very skillfully to also do, you know, the racism card and racism. I think he played that very, very well. So I think he played up racist fears. He played it very well. He knew exactly what he was doing. I think he was a very astute follower of history. I think his announcement was very reminiscent of what Reagan did when he announced his candidacy in, for presidency in 79, when he came down here to Mississippi and went to the site where, you know, Emmett Till was murdered to announce his candidacy. A lot of people forget that. You know, he came out with some great slogans. You know, Reagan did and so did Trump, you know, to make America great again. I think many on the left laughed at it, but I think, you know, anybody who watches Westerns, knew exactly what he was doing and he was appealing upon that history and that narrative and he played it well. I think he picked the perfect target with the, you know, spoke to both concerns about racism and economics with targeting the wall and targeting Mexico, so he kind of knocked out several things it all at once. And then I think, you know, the rise of Occupy and the rise of the movement for Black Lives, I think also present a certain amount of angst, you know, amongst a large sectors of, you know, particular rural, white America about being excluded, about, you know, narrative about being overrun, isolated, marginalized, forgotten. He played all that up, you know, and, you know, he did a good job. I think people need to recognize that in terms of, you know, what his strategy was and where the lack of strategy really was on the other side.
I mean, you mentioned, of course, that this was, that this is still sort of a minority movement that, I mean, nearly half of voting age Americans don't vote. And then
that's
a small percentage of people voted for Trump, and then he you know, won the Electoral College, not the popular vote. Why is it important to remember that kind of a thing when thinking about resisting Trump?
I always bring it up because I think people feel isolated, number one.
Yeah.
You know, which is in part what I call late capitalism or neoliberalism. Part of what is socially it's designed to engineer. And I think that speaks to, you know, the impact of that political movement, and neoliberalism needs to be understood as a political movement. I think first and foremost, what it was trying to accomplish in breaking down social solidarity. And I think it's done a good job over 40 years, you know, clearly. And as far clearly as we see with what we are calling the neo-Confederate states, And the Trump regime, that many thought that, there was not much more to squeeze after 2008 and that there would be enough consciousness about the failure of those policies and orientation, that there would be major resistance. I think that's proven, some clearly been proven false, and they're going to try to squeeze us even more, I think very hard and fast, beginning the next couple of weeks. I mean, we already see it with, you know, the repeal on the Senate floor, yesterday with, the repeal of, Obamacare. You know, and Trump's not even a president, officially yet, even though he's acting, as such. But we need to recognize that in a number of different instances, that folks who actually want to see something different constitute the majority. You know, there were majority of people who voted against Trump, if you just look at there. And I would also wager, even on a deeper level, this is something that we need to look at, I think, more profoundly and really try to address. But, you know, the 50% of voting age adults in this country who typically don't vote, I don't think that that is apathy, or not all of it in any sense. I think there's a growing just dissatisfaction with the facade of democracy, and people knowing that whoever I vote for, nothing fundamentally is going to change. You know, that their economic policy is going to be what it is. You know, a lot of the critical fundamental questions around society are not on the ballot. They're restricted from being included in any serious discussion of democracy and what we can vote on. So why should I vote? And I think that's speaking and begging for some more fundamental, deeper, and systemic change that I don't think, you know, the electoral strategy and the electoral focus that we've been, we in this case being the left, have been so kind of oriented towards touches upon. And I think we're time and time again, I think particularly over the last 20 years, where we've demonstrated our greatest strength is actually in the social movement side, the resistance side. And we have to find ways, I think, to build the type of organizations and institutions that can build kind of a radical hegemonic project that is just, that's beyond episodic, that's beyond just Occupy, or beyond just the movement for Black Lives, but is really geared towards meeting kind of direct needs, but in the process, creating new types of social relationships, transformer social relationships that speak to a kind of prefigurative politics that are creating the society that we want, that we envision, and that we need. And I think it's very critical for us to realize that, and we have to figure out, well, how do we rebuild the social bonds? How do we rebuild the social solidarity that we need? I don't think any of us have by far all of the answers, but I think some things are kind of staring us in the face, and I think constantly pointing that out, that we, those of us who want a different path and who actually chose a different path in the means that was available, we were in the majority and not in the minority. We need to look toward each other first and foremost for the solutions that we need.
So what you were just saying leads us pretty perfectly to talking about what you guys are building in Jackson and what went on with the Chakwe Lumumba election and mm-hmm. what's still happening with Cooperation Jackson. So tell us a little bit for people who don't know about Lumumba, and then what's still going on with Cooperation Jackson.
And I'll give kind of the shortest version I can of the overall kind of project and strategy. But, you know, after so I'm a member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, longtime member. After September 11th, one of the key things that we have been working on, which is securing the freedom of our political prisoners, prisoners of war, and political exiles, we kind of recognized after September 11th that that was going to become a major challenge, if not impossible, just given how the United States government was going to redefine, you know, the political terrain on an international level. And we kind of really recognized that we were going to have to do some major shifts in our own orientation and strategy, and that, you know, the things that we were doing before were not going to cut it in the next generation. And that, you know, we need to reposition ourselves and try some new things. One of the main things that we recognized, you know, was that the repressive nature of the United States government was going to reach new levels, and that, you know, the COINTELPRO program, which was devastating to Black liberation and socialist organizations, you know, Chicano, indigenous organizations, you know, that was fundamentally a secret program of the United States government, largely illegal, actually, by their own law and standards. And we knew that after September 11th, that they were going to create something that would be COINTELPRO-like. We didn't know it would be to the extent that it would be kind of COINTELPRO legalized on steroids, but we knew that that was coming. So we started to really, we created a strategy group, and we really started to try to rethink what we were doing, and with the limited resources and the limited kind of human forces that we have, how could we be more effective? And it took us a couple of years to really kind of narrow some stuff down. And then after Katrina, it really got sharpened and focused on us. And we really just started to take, you know, climate change a bit more seriously, particularly once we really looked at the maps of the United States and kind of recognized, you know, where major sea level rise would impact, and most of it being in low-lying communities in the South that are highly concentrated by Black people. So, you know, we said, okay, you know, where are we strongest? Where could a small organization, small radical organization, really kind of bore itself in and have the greatest amount of impact? And for a lot of different reasons, we looked at Mississippi, we looked at Jackson in particular, part because we already had a very strong chapter there. They had a very, you know, kind of profound history of organizing there and had some major victories in the 80s and 90s. And said, you know, what could we do that would lend us towards being in a position to shape the outcome of society on a municipal scale? And that led us to the creation of the Jackson-Cush Plan. And, you know, out of that plan, there were some elements of things that we were already working on, like people's assemblies. We kind of reshaped them, refocused it, repurposed it in a lot of ways to try to be an instrument of dual power, something that can both press, you know, government, but also work outside of it to transform society, to really push for independent political politics and political orientation. And then the third part of which is where Cooperation Jackson comes in, is transforming the economy, creating a democratic economy, leaning toward the creation and construction of a socialist economy, but, you know, through a democratic, you know, bottom-up process, right? Somewhat different than many of the experiments of the 20th century, which we both applaud on a very critical level and trying to learn from. So the first major piece that we put forward outside of the People's Assembly's work that had already been going on to really try to actualize that strategy was the election of Chokwe Lumumba. And we first ran Chokwe for city council in 2009, and he won that election. And we wanted to do that first and foremost to kind of gain some knowledge, gain some experience in the art of governing and kind of learning municipal law, municipal code, and to really kind of try to figure out, you know, what could be done on a municipal level to support, you know, kind of a radical program of social transformation. And we found out, you know, which I think was a good call, you know, that despite many of our, you know, years, if not decades, of studying radical theory and process, that we really didn't have and didn't encounter many who had any serious analysis on how to actually govern. So those first 4 years, we learned a little bit. We felt confident enough that we wanted to try and move it to the next scale. And we ran Chokwe for mayor in 2012 and 2013. He won in 2013. He took over the mayorship in July. And, you know, he held that position until his untimely death in February 2014. Cooperation Jackson, you know, the vehicle for something like Cooperation Jackson had been thought of for over 10 years prior to Chokwe becoming mayor, right? We knew we wanted to build something like what Cooperation Jackson is and is becoming. But our initial thinking was then that the first thing we wanted to do was to change some of the municipal law to support local hiring, local buying, local procurement, to change some of the rules of the game in a way that they would support not just minority kind of contractors and builders, but people who were doing kind of collective work, cooperative work. So we want to do that, and then we also wanted to create process and a system and orientation wherein we could create a kind of a capital stream for these emerging vehicles to really have some of the resources or capitalization that they needed to get off their feet. And we were putting some of those things in place, and I was working for the Lumumba administration and working directly on those particular things when he died. And so they kind of were, I hate to use this analogy, but they were stillborn. So the idea was there, but the next administration didn't take it up and had no regard for it. And on our part, we just said, hey, you know, it was an untimely, unfortunate loss, but we need to keep the process moving forward and to try to move on to the next and third phase, which we always start with the most critical phase, which is, you know, how do you organize a community to both own and seize the means of production, you know, within this environment. And that is where Cooperation Jackson was born. That's where it came into place. And, you know, that is still a process that we're working on and trying to cultivate and develop. You know, we're experimenting left and right, many things working, many things, you know, not. But it's all kind of part of this process of, A, trying to build a democratic culture, and to do that on the level of production, which is more of a challenge than it sounds like, because, you know, we don't really live in a democratic society. I think the more you really try to get into work like this, the more you really kind of realize how undemocratic the overall society that we live in really is, particularly when it comes to the economic realm. All that is geared towards private accumulation. You know, it's a boss who tells you, you know, not without struggle, you know, but for workers for better wages and better working conditions. But for the most part, given the balance of forces and how weak, you know, the working class is in this country, most of that is really dictated by our employers and by capital, which is not democratic in any form or fashion when it ultimately kind of comes down to it. We definitely see it as a long-term struggle. We see it as one that's become harder with Trump's election and the potential consolidation that the political forces he represents really kind of molding with these Tea Party neo-Confederates and their control over you know, state governments. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, I do think in a moment like this, living in Mississippi has been an advantage because, you know, we live in a Tea Party state. Mississippi has been dominated by the Tea Party even before it kind of the political forces who had that orientation even before the party kind of had its name. But, right. You know, our governor, Phil Bryant, is a Tea Party member. We have a Republican supermajority, and it's been that way for most of the last 6 years, and they can virtually pass, you know, almost anything they want. You know, so we've been able to kind of sharpen some ideas on how do you resist, how do you organize in such a repressive and constrictive context. Before the nation kind of got hit and exposed with this, with the Trump presidency. I think we kind of had a little bit of a head start, which I think kept us from being, at least our core, as kind of depressed by what just transpired. Meaning we were like, you know, welcome to Mississippi, you know, to the rest of the United States. This is what we've been going through. We don't wish this on our worst enemies, but this is where we find ourselves. Crying about it or, you know, wishing it was different is not going to change the situation. We're going to have to get down, get dirty, and struggle and work our way out of this. And our orientation is that, you know, we have to be fighting both defensively and offensively as much as we can at the same time. And that's very challenging to do, but I think it's an orientation that we have to really pivot towards. And I think it's a time, you know, going back on some old cliches, which I do think are true, you know, it's a time for us to really dream big, to vision big, much bigger and bolder than I think we've thought in most of the last 30 years as we've kind to, I think, acquiesce and accept Tina. There is no alternative when actually there is and has to be, because if the forces that are at the helm now, if they continue to have their way, humanity won't survive. much longer. So it's imperative that we not only kind of remove them from power, but we totally reorient the economy and society to one that is in balance and harmony with nature. We get a real good grip on decarbonizing the economy, really putting forth a just transition. I think these are necessities, and we have to build it from, you know, from the ground up, and that's what we're trying to do in cooperation with Jackson here in Mississippi. You know, one thing, you know, that's coming up, Chokwe Lumumba's son, Chokwe Antar Lumumba, is running for mayor. Our mayoral election is going to be in May and June. Right now, by far and away, he's the leading candidate, so we kind of fully expect to be back in office, come July, but under some new terms that we're really going to have to figure out, you know, because the city is under it's a major debt now. We're being threatened with the loss of our school district. The state is likely going to take that over because of some arbitrary grading system that they created, you know, several years ago, primarily focused and targeted on black school districts. Jackson is also faced with the threat of losing control over the city's water system, in part because of a consent decree that the city was forced to sign, you know, with the federal government in 2012, even though the city knew that it had to fix the water, and the water situation has been bad going on into the 1970s. So they just kind of kicked that can down the road until it became inevitable. And Jackson has a water problem similar to Flint, not as bad. For us, it's a key issue because, you know, the sale of water to both the residents of the city and the greater metro region constitutes 44% of the city's annual revenue. So if we lose control of the water, we fundamentally really won't have a municipality of any serious note to speak of. So, you know, we're trying to avoid what I call a Syriza trap, you know, which is kind of having a left-wing government come in to administer the worst forms of austerity, you know, that finance capital can come up with. And that's a similar situation that we're kind of staring down, but we're trying to meet that as best we can with the most radical democratic ideas to counter it as we possibly can. But the road ahead of us, I think, is very clear that we're going to take a major risk in to steal a phrase in inventing the future to deal with, you know, some of the issues that I spoke to earlier about black disposability in the current and growing economic reality that we face, this globalized world, and how it's increasingly becoming more and more computerized and more automated, which is going to have some major consequences for labor displacement. Ultimately, what we think is disposability on a grand and global scale that we need to get prepared for now. And we do so, in our view, by fighting and creating a program which is about democratizing technology and putting it in the direct hand of the community so that we kind of control the process of who and how automation is going to serve humanity and not just serve the 1% or small elite. You know, we dream big here. We believe visioning small and trying to act in a very small and isolated way actually doesn't help us in the broader left project in any form or fashion. We don't believe single issue work and orientation and struggle is the way forward. And we have to push beyond our capacity as we presently understand it. We think that helps people to come out of their isolation, to have some hope, which we think is important, and to start envisioning a future, you know, where they can be active participants in its construction.
Lastly, can you just tell people where they can find Ungovernable, where they can find Cooperation Jackson, how they can find out more information?
You can reach Cooperation Jackson at our website, first and foremost, which is cooperationjackson.org. Our Facebook page, which is Cooperation Jackson. Facebook and Twitter are if you want to get kind of more up to date on what we're thinking, what we're doing, the Facebook page is the best place to go. That is in Twitter, and our Twitter handle is CooperationJXN. You know, you can find us there. For the Ungovernable Initiative, I want to encourage everyone to look at, first and foremost, the website, which is ungovernable2017.org or .com. You can reach either way. And to also look for the new Ungovernable Facebook page that we're also using to kind of do regular updates and analysis And right now, we're trying to get everybody to kind of take the ungovernable pledge to join in actions in your city, in your state, or if you can make it to D.C. for the 20th and 21st to do that, and to stay tuned for the broader, more long-term initiative, because it's, you know, one day is not going to stop this regime from moving by any stretch of the imagination, and we got to start organizing and building for, you know, not just immediate survival and hopefully overturning of the Trump regime, but transforming society. We hope everybody will join us.
Thank you for listening. Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fulibois and support from the Nation Institute. Thanks to all of our partner publications, The Baffler, The Progressive, Truth Out in These Times. You can find out more on the web at necessarytrouble.org and reach me there if you'd like to become a partner publication. We will be back soon.